From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tomorrow, Thabo Mbeki becomes South Africa's second black president. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the president who dismantled apartheid, F.W. de Klerk. He freed Nelson Mandela from prison, and they shared a Nobel Peace Prize. De Klerk is from a family of prominent Afrikaner politicians. He first served in the apartheid government in 1972. We'll talk about why he decided it was time to end the system that he and his family had upheld. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Music for Torching by A.M. Holmes, a new novel about a middle-aged couple who feels stuck in their lives. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Television reports from Mexico City say a powerful earthquake killed at least one person and injured more than 200 in the city of Puebla. The quake, measuring 6.7 on the Richter scale, caused buildings to sway in Mexico City and sent office workers pouring into the streets. Puebla, which was closer to the epicenter, suffered damage to historic buildings, trapping some people in the rubble. Two refugees were killed trying to return to Kosovo today when they stepped on landmines just across the Macedonian border. Several thousand Kosovars made it across, even though the United Nations has warned them it's not yet safe to return. NPR's Melissa Block reports.
While the refugees waited in a line of about 50 cars backed up at the border, convoys of NATO forces drove across in armored personnel carriers and jeeps and trucks. Many refugees walked over the border crossing, carrying the few possessions they have left, some bringing in tomatoes or loaves of bread. Many of those returning were men, going back to Kosovo to check on the condition of their homes and villages. While they intended to come back later to pick up the rest of their families, they won't be allowed to do so. Macedonian authorities are not allowing the Kosovars to re-enter Macedonia once they leave. UN officials are handing out leaflets warning of the dangers of landmines and urging the refugees to wait until it's safe to return. But many Kosovars said they're anxious to find family members they left behind and don't want to wait another day. Melissa Block, NPR News at Blatze on the Kosovo-Macedonian border.
More than 200 Russian troops continue to occupy the main airport in Pristina, and today more Russians arrived in a convoy that brought food and other supplies to the occupiers. NATO spokesman Jamie Shea said the alliance doesn't oppose the Russian forces getting food and water. North Korean and South Korean military vessels clashed today in the Yellow Sea. South Korean warships sank one vessel from the north and damaged others. U.S. diplomats are trying to keep the conflict from getting any worse. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
There were casualties on both sides, and U.S. officials say they're monitoring the situation closely. But there's been no change in the state of readiness of U.S. forces based in South Korea. State Department spokesman James Rubin.
We're working closely with the South Korean authorities to try to defuse the situation and reduce tensions. We have contacted the North Korean authorities through the New York Channel to urge strongly that they remain north of the northern limit line.
The northern limit line establishes a buffer zone that's supposed to prevent north-south clashes in the Yellow Sea. But North Korea does not regard the line as legitimate. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 31 points today to close at 10,594 in moderate trading. This is NPR. The head of the Federal Communications Commission warned today that there would be chaos if local governments are able to set the rules for high-speed internet access. FCC Chairman Bill Kennard urged the cable industry to appeal a recent local court ruling requiring open access to cable lines there. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
2 weeks ago, a court in Portland, Oregon, ruled that authorities there can compel the local cable TV company to offer a choice of internet service providers. In a speech today, Bill Kennard told cable executives he was surprised they have not asked for federal relief from that ruling. He noted that there are 30,000 different franchising authorities in the U.S. and said the information superhighway will not work if each of those bodies makes different demands of companies offering high-speed internet access. Internet service providers have argued that consolidation competition in the cable industry threatens the tradition of open access to the Internet. Cable companies say any regulation of the nascent cable Internet business would kill investment. But in his speech, Kinnaird also urged the cable industry to voluntarily respect the open tradition of the Internet. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Congress and President Clinton honored civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks today at a ceremony on Capitol Hill. Mrs. Parks received the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest civilian award that Congress gives. Mrs. Parks triggered the 1955 bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, when she refused to give up her seat to a white man and was arrested. The boycott, led by local minister Martin Luther King Jr., lasted about a year until the Supreme Court ruled that Montgomery's bus segregation law was unconstitutional. Mrs. Parks is now 86. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow, South African President Nelson Mandela steps down, and Thabo Mbeki becomes the second president of post-apartheid South Africa. My guest, F.W. de Klerk, was the president who presided over the dismantling of apartheid. 6 months after becoming president in 1990, in a startling address, he announced he was lifting the ban on the ANC, the African National Congress, and releasing Nelson Mandela from prison. Then he began negotiating a new constitution with Mandela and other black leaders. De Klerk and Mandela shared a Nobel Peace Prize in 1993. De Klerk ran against Mandela for the presidency and lost. He served as deputy president until June 1996 and retired from politics in 1997. Now De Klerk has written an autobiography. He was first elected to parliament in 1972, held six cabinet positions, and was a leader of the National Party, which created and upheld apartheid. I asked at what point in his career he realized he wanted to end apartheid.
I never had what one can call a Damascus Road experience. There wasn't one particular point where suddenly I got clarity in my mind. I, together with my colleagues in the National Party, with my co-leaders, I've been a leader of one of our provinces since 1982, went through a whole process. Reform really started tentatively when I entered Parliament, not because I entered Parliament, but when I entered Parliament in 1972, 73. But it really picked up when we had a change of Prime Minister, when P.W. Botha became Prime Minister in 78. That year also coincided with me becoming part of the Cabinet. And right from the beginning, his message was, we must look at fundamental reform. This led to a split in the National Party, the more conservative element breaking away early in 1982, and since then reform really started to roll. First, we changed our constitution and brought what is referred to as the so-called coloureds, people of mixed origin, and Indians into the mainstream of politics. We then still believed that black political rights should be fully achieved through the route of independent states for the various black nations within South Africa. But there was a cabinet committee on which I served, which was called the Constitutional Reform Cabinet Committee or something like that. And we worked at what should our final goal be, what can work in South Africa, how can we bring justice to all. And it was becoming clearer and clearer that the old way in which we wanted to bring justice was simply just not working. The demographic realities was against it, the economic realities was against it, and the majority of black people, for whom the solution of independent states and a confederation of states in Southern Africa was intended, the majority rejected it. And this led to the National Party abandoning the policy of apartheid, abandoning the whole concept of separate development formally in August 1986. We then held an all-white election in May 87 and said, give us a mandate for a new vision of one united South Africa with one citizenship, with one person, one vote, with all forms of discrimination to be abolished, but with the effective protection of the cultural and language rights of our many cultural minorities. So if there was a real turning point where we formalized the abandonment of the concept of separate development, it was August 1986.
I'm wondering if you see your role in the ending of apartheid as being motivated by ethics or something much more practical than that.
In this process, which I've just described, there was really a strong element of taking a long, hard look at ourselves. And in my personal motivation, the quest for justice was the driving force. So it was much more ethical. I'm not saying that sanctions, that the growing isolation of South Africa, that the rising threat of terrorism didn't play a role and did not influence maybe also the pace of things, but the decision to change was an ethical decision, was acceptance that we, instead of having achieved justice, that we were actually continuing to keep alive a system which has become inherently unjust and morally unjustifiable. And therefore, we didn't try to just reform separate development. We abandoned it and made a 180-degree turn.
When you were elected, Nelson Mandela had already been holding secret talks with members of government and the Minister of Prisons. This was while he was in prison. Did you know about those talks when you became president?
Yes. I became leader of my party on the 2nd of February 1989. And having been elected as leader of the party, that really made me, within the framework of the constitution and the political situation as it then was, the president-elect. And immediately, I was then fully briefed. I did not know about it. I had a vague sort of suspicion that this was happening, but I was not part of P.W. Botha's inner circle. I was then immediately fully briefed, and since then I was kept abreast of all the developments until I became president and started issuing the orders.
So what was your reaction when you found out about these secret talks?
I welcomed it. The background was that I was supportive of other efforts of P.W. Botha to release Mandela. Mandela was offered twice to be released by P.W. Botha, my predecessor. The first time he was asked to sign an undertaking to go and live in what we regarded as an independent country. The rest of the world did not recognize it, the Transkei. Mandela refused. There was another effort where it was suggested that if Mandela signs a document in which he undertakes to not to participate in what they call the armed struggle, in which he basically rejects the armed struggle, in which he distances himself from political violence, also by the ANC, he once again refused to do so. So everybody within the government and within the leadership of the National Party realized that Mandela has been in jail too long, that he has become an icon, that he has become a martyr in the eyes of the rest of the world. And also within the framework of our own penal system, he was there too long. Life was at that stage regarded as about 21 years. And then murderers and the like who had life would often be released after 20 or 21 years, and he was then already there 25, 26, when I released him 27 years.
So are you saying that you thought he was doing you more harm than good by being in prison because of the potent symbol he had become, because he had become an icon?
Yes, that's from one viewpoint. From another viewpoint, also, he has paid his dues. Mm-hmm. He has served his sentence, and justice also required that he should be released.
How did your first impressions of Nelson Mandela compare to what you expected?
I was not surprised or taken by surprise in the sense that I was briefed that he about him, about his personality, about how he conducted the other discussions in which he was involved with the Minister of Prisons, with senior officials, and so on. But when I met him physically, for instance, he was taller than I expected. He had, which he still has, an air of dignity around him. I found him a fairly impressive man. He had a firm handshake. We had a good discussion. We did not really discuss anything of substance. We were sort of testing each other, probing in an effort to decide, can we trust each other? And both of us, he in his long walk to freedom and I in my last trek, A New Beginning, said of each other that we felt we could do business, that there was an integrity on which we could build.
Given that you had a relationship of, you had a kind of adversarial relationship, but two people who had agreed to work together, what was your feelings about Nelson Mandela as you accepted the Nobel Peace Prize together?
Yeah, can I just say about the adversarial, it was mainly caused by Mandela's accusations that I was not doing enough to end the violence, to end the killing. In the end, he has now been president for 5 years. He's retiring within a few days. I think he has learned that a president can't just push a button, that what happens at grassroots level is not within your direct control, and that the real test is, what do you do to prevent this? What do you do to find the culprits if things are being done which should not be done by those under your command or under your authority? When we stood there, it was mixed feelings. I was glad that that which I stood for was given the recognition. I did not regard myself as the individual who achieved that. I was receiving it on behalf of the people that I represented in the negotiation situation and in initiating the fundamental transformation process. I never had any doubts that he also deserved it. And I've never had any feelings of jealousy with regard to the wonderful recognition which he is getting and which he was getting there alongside me.
My guest is former South African President F.W. de Klerk, who presided over the ending of apartheid. He's written a new autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is F.W. de Klerk, the former South African president who ended apartheid and received a Nobel Peace Prize with Nelson Mandela for ending it. When you were looking into the future and trying to figure out what to do as president of South Africa, what were the alternatives you saw to ending apartheid? Say you didn't end it and tried to keep the system going. Did you see revolution ahead? Did you see a bloody end to white rule? Did you see a failed economy for South Africa? What were the alternatives?
I saw catastrophe looming. I saw that we would, if we clung to power and if we just tinkered here and there with reforms, that we would become more and more isolated, that the whole world would be united with the majority of all the people in South Africa behind one common goal, and that is to turn us on our head, to turn our country on its head. I saw hundreds of thousands of people dying in that process. I saw the country's economy destroyed if we were to do that. And I really think there was no reasonable alternative to the one which we chose.
I'm sure you opposed the sanctions against South Africa when you were in the government, but I'm wondering in retrospect if you think the sanctions were a real impetus to end apartheid. I'm thinking of economic sanctions and of, isolating South African sports teams, for instance. You used to be the head of sports and entertainment, so those boycotts really affected you in a very personal way.
Yeah, but let me use it as an example. I, as a young minister, once had the Department of Sport falling under me. I was also the Minister of Sport. When I was Minister of Sport, we changed our policy to one of total withdrawal, depoliticizing sport fully. And we recognized the full autonomy of all sports organizations and said that we would not prescribe to them in any way whatsoever. They immediately abolished all racial discrimination in many sports. So we complied with what the world wanted us to do in the field of sport. Instead of rewarding us and saying, right, now you can play again, they continued with the sport sanctions. This is a good example of how South Africans then felt, well, the sanctions are not really bona fide. And it won't help to make concessions, because there is no reward if we make concessions. What the world wants is not for us to reform. They want us to hand over power to what was then a communist-supported organization which was fighting against everything that the West stood for. The ANC was supported fully by the USSR when it was still a world power. Russia, there's no doubt about it, had an expansionist policy in the whole of southern Africa. There was a war in which we fought against many, many thousands of Cubans, which were brought in with the financial support into southern Africa, into Angola, right on our borders. So it was more complicated than sort of sanctions just because of apartheid and we either changing apartheid or not. There was a complicated set of interactive factors. In the end, sanctions at times delayed reform, because sanctions was used to mobilize white public opinion. There was a great anti-American feeling at a certain stage. John Foster in 1977 won the greatest victory ever of the National Party on the basis of an anti-American platform in the election campaign because of the sanctions and because of the damage which it was doing and because of what was regarded as unreasonable demands. As a matter of principle, don't believe in sanctions, not just in the South African situation. Sanctions should be reserved for extremely serious situations where engagement and discussion and other ways of influencing decisions clearly cannot succeed.
Wasn't the situation in South Africa extremely serious? And hadn't attempts to end apartheid through discourse failed completely?
No, because as I said earlier in our program, there was fundamental reforms already in beginning in early 80s. Throughout the 80s, there was a clear indication that we were on the path of fundamental reform.
But I think
and
a lot
I,
of,
as a,
you know,
I, as a minister, toured the world in my many portfolios that I've held. And so did my colleagues, and we explained this, and we were listened to. But nonetheless, the sanctions remained. We weren't given recognition and encouragement to reform. It was the stick remained, even though the indications were clear that apartheid was crumbling, that those in charge were themselves considering and busy breaking it down.
What I'm saying
is sanctions was kept for too long. Even after my speech of the 2nd of February 1990, we weren't immediately given full recognition. Still, the governments of the world didn't want to displease the ANC. And the ANC, even after having been unbanned, with Mandela released, with everything in place for negotiations, insisted that sanctions should stay in place until, as they would have phrased it then, until they take over power.
But don't you think a lot of international leaders and many citizens around the world felt, don't you think they felt that a reformed system of apartheid wasn't good enough, only the end of apartheid was
the But since 1986, we made it clear. Since 1986, we made it clear that we're not going to reform apartheid, that we're going to abolish apartheid. I think they didn't believe us. I think we had to build up credibility, and this is one of the reasons why I made the speech on the 2nd of February in the way I did. That is why I instead of doing things step by step, I decided to, with one bold stroke, do almost everything at once, in order to impress on the rest of the world and on everybody concerned that we can be trusted on this, that we are not playing around or fooling around. But since 86, what we said to world leaders was, there will no longer be apartheid. We are going to abolish it. We want to do it quickly, but we need to do it in an orderly way so as to prevent chaos from taking over.
F.W. de Klerk has written a new autobiography. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Bantam Books, publishers of The Scalpel and the Silver Bear, a memoir by the first Navajo woman surgeon, Dr. Lori Arviso Alvord, about her efforts to combine Western medicine and traditional healing. Available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the decision to end apartheid. We continue our conversation with F.W. de Klerk, the former president of South Africa. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Music for Torching, the new novel about middle-aged suburban angst by A.M. Holmes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with former South African President F.W. de Klerk, who presided over the end of apartheid. 6 months after becoming president, he released Nelson Mandela from prison. They shared a Nobel Peace Prize in 1993. De Klerk was first elected to parliament in 1972 and became a leader of the National Party, which created and upheld the apartheid system. Did you ever have a change of heart morally about apartheid?
Yes. But once again, it was...
Gradual?
It was gradual. It was a process. I supported, with great idealism, separate development, because I believed that the end goal which we had was morally justifiable, namely, to give full political rights to everybody living in South Africa, but along the route of nation states. We have 11 official languages. South Africa is one of the most diverse societies in the world. And Zulu is as different from Sotho as French is from German. So we still have that diversity. And we wanted to build a little Europe there, where the Zulus would have Zululand and the Xhosas would have the Transkei, and the Sotho's would have their country, and the Tswana's their country, and the Afrikaners, the whites, would have their country. And all those countries would cooperate in something like a confederation with regard to their common interests. You know, this is the solution which the whole world today supports for Israel and Palestine. The basis of the separation which the world supports is ethnic. It's religious, and they say the solution is the establishment of a separate state.
There's some real differences,
so
though.
That is what I supported, but yeah. In the end, that did not succeed. Although four of those countries did accept independence, the world refused to recognize them. The majority said, yes, we will take powers, but more or less equal to the powers that your states have within a federal system. So, in the end, it led to morally unjustifiable discrimination on the basis of race and ethnicity, and that was and is morally unjustifiable.
In terms of the ethnic separation in South Africa, there's a difference between that and, say, the Israeli-Palestine situation. The blacks really had no say in the creation of apartheid. Blacks were thrown out of their homes and exiled to so-called homelands, and then were deprived of rights in the larger society. So it doesn't really seem like a comparable situation.
Yeah, but you see, it was quite different from how you describe it. The homelands wasn't created by us. It's part of history. As Lesotho, which the British made independent, was the homeland of the Sotho's, and still is. But more than half of the Sotho's work in South Africa. And they have family back in Lesotho, and they go back for holidays, and they go back for weekends. And likewise, Botswana, which Great Britain made independent, more than half of its population is not living in Botswana. And likewise, Swaziland. So the old colonial borders in Africa really didn't always make sense. So we didn't create it and then said, now we've created an artificial homeland, now all of you go back. We said, come and work here. We improve the housing, but exercise your basic political rights there. Here, yes, choose your own mayor. Have your own structures for local government. But at the national level, let us exercise our political rights through our main political basis, the countries where we rule ourselves as different peoples and as different nations. It's like a Frenchman working in London but voting for the French government. That was the concept.
But the practicality always included passbooks and police oppression. a kind of built-in poverty since there were no economic options. You know, men having to travel to white town to white cities to work, but not being able to take their families with them. So families were divided.
That part is what led to the downfall of apartheid. The moral, unjustified part. The pain that it caused. For that, I have apologized. I have acknowledged the wrongness of that. We believed at the time that it would be temporary, that it would pass, that that was a necessary phase to achieve the goal. In the end, it was perpetuated, and it caused a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and a lot of loss of opportunity. And for that, I have profusely and very strongly apologized in the clearest of terms. I'm not trying to justify that. My book is about explaining what the thinking patterns were at different stages. We must remember that when the word apartheid was coined, apartheid was implemented in the United States. The colonies were still colonies. The colonial powers were still, I would almost say, raping Africa without really being worried about political rights. Then the winds of change, as a former British Prime Minister Macmillan called it, blew through the whole world and also through Africa. The whole colonial system subsided. Also here, you had your problems in the abolishment of the separate but equal approach. And we fell out of step in the late 50s and in the 60s with the rest of the world. And then from the middle 60s, reform began, and the realization that we were falling out of step began to dawn. And I think, yes, we clung too long. The question is whether it was possible to do what I did, let's say, in 1970, or in 1975, or even in 1980. Or would any leader who did what I did at that stage have been merely just rejected and replaced by another leader? That's an issue of speculation.
My guest is former South African President F.W. de Klerk, who presided over the ending of apartheid. He's written a new autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. F.W. de Klerk is my guest. He's just written an autobiography about his life and about his role as the president of South Africa who ended apartheid and received a Nobel Peace Prize for it. You come from a family of political leaders. Your great-grandfather, grandfather, and father were all in government. And, you know, members of your family played a role in building and upholding the apartheid system. And I'm wondering, looking about what you think of your family's participation.
They weren't hardline racists. They didn't hate anybody. They didn't want to suppress. They wanted to defend what was theirs, namely the right to self-determination. We fought a war in which 26,000 women and children died in concentration camps against Great Britain, when they annexed the republics within which my forebears achieved full independence and political rights. We drenched the soil of South Africa to fight for our political rights. And that is what they wanted to defend. But they didn't want to defend it on the basis of not also granting it to others. They just wanted a system. This was the driving force, a system which would allow them to retain their self-determination while others achieve it alongside them. And firmly believed that if they opened up the system on the basis of one man, one vote, within the framework of the demographic realities being a minority vis-a-vis black South Africans, that they would then lose that right. This was what I was brought up with.
Between the Goldstone Commission on the Prevention of Public Violence and Intimidation, which examined human rights abuses under apartheid, and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a lot of injustices have come to the surface, especially a lot of police abuse. And I know that you've denied knowledge of most of these things until they were brought to the surface by these commissions. But a lot of people have wondered, how could you have not known, being such an insider in government, how could you have not known what so many outsiders suspected?
Because there was no policy which authorized such atrocities. Because even the heads of the departments who were directly, from a managerial point of view, in charge, the chief of police, the head of the defense force, also did not know. They did not apply for amnesty. They, to this day, deny knowledge of these atrocities. They were the people who briefed me. There is, let me use an example. There's police brutality throughout the world. You have recently had cases of police brutality.
Absolutely.
Is the president, should he know about this? Should the mayor of New York know about this? Should the governor of the state know about this? Shouldn't the test be, what do you do to prevent it? What are the rules to prevent it? What systems do you have in place to prevent it? And if it nonetheless happens, what do you do to root it out? And what do you do to punish those who are guilty?
It just seems that...
And that I describe in my book, that we had systems in place. When somebody was killed and there was an allegation that there was security force involvement, there would be an investigation. Every violent death was followed by an inquest with a magistrate, with the police bringing whatever evidence is available, as in the States, as in England, as in any civil society. There were rules in place. I strengthened the rules when I became president. I broke down the securocrat system. I reduced the big conglomerate which was around the so-called State Security Council. I reduced it to 3 people. I then stopped even convening the State Security Council. I appointed the Harms Commission. When the Harms Commission, to my mind, did not really penetrate and got to the bottom of the truth, I appointed Goldstone. I didn't leave a stone unturned. And when there was evidence, police were charged in an open court. In one case, which I clearly now remember, a policeman, as a result of these investigations, was found guilty of complicity in murder and was sentenced to death. I wasn't protecting it. I wasn't looking away and sort of just turning my back on this. I was insisting that each and every allegation, when there seems to be some credibility in it, should be followed up, and that it should be investigated properly. And I empowered the police. At one stage, I considered establishing a branch outside the police to do these investigations. We then finally settled on rather the Goldstone Commission.
I understand what you're saying, but you were saying there were rules in place, but weren't those rules systematically violated by the police, and weren't some of the investigations more like cover-ups?
Well, yes, I was worried about that, and I insisted in meetings. It is described in Patty Waldmeyer's book about South Africa. I insisted, I asked my ministers, are you sure that you are not being led up the garden path. I ask these heads of department, do I have your absolute assurance? I pushed. But more than that, in the change of policy, there was an element which did not agree with what we were doing in the political field. There was an element which regarded what I announced and what I was implementing as a catastrophe. There was an element who decided they would actively undermine my reform and transformation process because they didn't want the new constitution as it is. They didn't want one man, one vote. They regarded, I was called in some of the amnesty hearings, a traitor by some of these people who committed these murders. So they were not on the point of sort of taking me into their confidence. They wanted to trip me up. There was also that element.
How is the New South Africa, how is living in the New South Africa different from life during apartheid?
It's different and it's not different. It's not different in the sense that everything is going on normally. The integration of residential areas has not caused any waves or problems. The integration at school level and at university is going fairly well. There are some incidents now and then, as you have some incidents now and then in your schools. But generally speaking, it's going in many fields better than even the most conservative people expected. There is tremendous goodwill. It has always been there inherently, but it is blooming now. There is, generally speaking, a good relationship between black and white and colored and Indian. The tension has gone. And this was illustrated so clearly in the two elections that we've had, where people stood together in queues, waiting patiently for their chance to vote, chatting with each other. So it's a much better place from many vantage points. But crime has risen. Unemployment has grown. We need more economic growth. There's still a skepticism. The very world, which said we must do what we do, what we did, is still withholding final judgment. The investors, yes, they're there with short-term investments, but we're not getting enough fixed and long-term investments. They want to see whether the new system will hold, whether they will adhere, the governing party will adhere to well-balanced economic policies. So we have tremendous challenges still. But at least we've made a good start. We have a good constitution. We have good rules in place. We must just make sure that it becomes a living document, our new Bill of Rights, and that our economy, through the establishment of confidence amongst investors that the system in South Africa will hold, will start growing in order to meet our unemployment problem.
Of all the decisions you made along the way to ending apartheid, is there any one decision that you're particularly proudest of?
Let me first say I have no regrets about any of the major decisions that I've made. And I'm proudest of the package that I put together for the 2nd of February 1990 because it succeeded to thaw the ice. It succeeded to establish credibility. It gave the process a kickstart, without which maybe we would still be negotiating now and there would still be tension and conflict.
And that includes the release of Nelson Mandela and the unbanning of the ANC?
Yes.
And now that you're retired from politics, how do you spend your time?
Well, I spent the first year writing the book. It's hard work writing such a book, checking and rechecking and triple-checking your facts. I have now registered and I will be launching a foundation. It will be called the F.W. de Klerk Foundation. It will have as one of its main aims to act as a catalyst and together with other establish something like a center for peace and reconciliation in South Africa, because in that regard, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission itself says it did not achieve its goal of really successfully promoting fundamental reconciliation. It will have as a focus to make our Constitution a living document, to strengthen it and uphold it. It will have as a focus in a totally non-party political way to promote multi-party democracy. And it will have as a focus to mobilize our civil society, the advantaged community in South Africa, to really reach out effectively to the disadvantaged and to come onto the playing field in helping to achieve a better life for all.
F.W. de Klerk has written a new autobiography. Tomorrow, Thabo Mbeki becomes the second president of post-apartheid South Africa. Coming up, music for torching. This is Fresh Air. A.M. Holmes has won critical acclaim for her story collection, The Safety of Objects, as well as her novels, including The End of Alice and In a Country of Mothers. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says her new novel, Music for Torching, is a scorcher.
The most frequently asked question I get as a book reviewer is, do you always read the whole book? And I hold up my right hand and answer, always. Reviewer's code of honor. A.M. Holmes' new novel, Music for Torching, provides an excellent example of why skipping any part of a book is dangerous, not to say unethical. Up until the last 25 pages of this novel, I had one opinion of it. Present tense edgy, engrossing, sometimes very funny, but ultimately kind of, pointless. Then at the very end, Holmes violently changes the texture of her novel, somehow without violating the integrity of her narrative. Those last pages possess the shocking, unreal feel of real-life tragedy, and they made me go back and ascribe a grave meaning to a lot of what had previously seemed aimless in the novel. Music for Torching takes place in Cheever, Updike land. Paul and Elaine are a middle-aged married couple living in Westchester with their two sons. Their friends, who they see regularly for parties where everybody drinks too much, are almost all married, too. Paul commutes to his advertising job in the city and has affairs. Elaine cooks lamb roasts and says things like, I'm stuck, I'm totally stuck. Her pre-feminist mother responds by telling her, you think you're supposed to have feelings about everything? You don't need to have so many feelings. What sets Holmes's characters apart from their suburban literary predecessors is the level of sadism they're willing to sink to in order to shake off their numbness. In the opening scene, Paul makes a date with a woman who's a guest at a Saturday night dinner party he and Elaine are hosting. After everybody leaves, he and Elaine engage in rough sex, during which they both sob. The next morning, Paul shaves his head. Later on, he'll shave off all his body hair, get a groin tattoo, and begin wearing women's lingerie. That's after he and Elaine deliberately set fire to their house with the barbecue grill and then take the kids out for dinner as they listen to sirens wailing in the distance. just another Pleasant Valley Sunday. Fortunately, Holmes has a nice instinct about when to relieve all this noisy desperation with moments of black comedy, so that empty, bored Paul and Elaine don't come off like split-level ranch house-dwelling parodies of Ingmar Bergman characters. Elaine has a divorced friend who's working on her PhD in women's studies, writing papers with titles like The Male Gaze as Displayed in Your Grocer's Dairy Case. When she and Paul take refuge from their smoldering house with neighbors who've attained a Martha Stewart level of good living, they realize that their feelings of defectiveness are totally legitimate. Here's that shared epiphany, which occurs around the neighbor's impeccable dinner table. Paul is no longer smiling. He and Elaine are staring down at their plates, ashamed. At their house, things don't go like this. Nothing is easy. It's every man for himself, each hoarding what little he has, each wanting his own, each wanting something different. They wait for disappointment. They constantly accumulate proof of having been let down, misunderstood, unappreciated. They are a tense and bitter lot, and haven't even noticed it until now. Still, a little ennui goes a long way. I got fed up with Paul and Elaine, their world weariness, and their wild attempts to relieve it. I wanted their lives to change. Then Holmes whipped up those last 25 pages that anticipate horrors we've recently seen and read about on the news, and I recalled, along with Paul and Elaine, the terrible truth of the old saw, "Be careful what you wish for, it may come true."
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Music for Torching by A.M. Holmes. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House, publishers of Morgan, American Financier, by Gene Strauss. From Vanguard Records, featuring Underneath, the latest release from David Wilcox, available at Barnes & Noble, with information at davidwilcox.com. And from Bantam Books, publisher of O Jerusalem, by Laurie R. King, a novel of suspense featuring Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes. Available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, handling White House scandals, we talk with Lanny Davis, former special counsel to President Clinton, who was the spokesperson for Clinton financial scandals. Davis has a new memoir about dealing with the president and the press. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.